This is the start of reading number 3 of the story. Amen.
For some unknown reason, the thermometer on the sled has broken. Sandy had a spare in his belongings, but when we finally found it, this one was also broken. Now the only way we could tell how cold it was by guessing. In the morning, each one of us would go outside of the tent, guess the temperature. Each guess was written down, and they were all added up and divided by 5. If there was 5 of us in the party, how close we came, we had no way of knowing. But this is the record that was kept. We had run out of toilet paper some time ago and had to resort to the use of snow. Whenever nature called, this was not too often, as we were now eating only one meal a day, and not too heavy at that. Using snow as a substitute for toilet paper is mighty unpleasant when the temperature registers at 30 below. Sandy had in his bedroll a reindeer skin that he slept on. I don't know who started this fad, but whenever someone needed a substitute for paper, when Mother Nature called, and Sandy was elsewhere occupied, he would cut a piece of the deer skin. Then one day Sandy remarked, "It's a funny thing in the tent how a deer skin shrinks up." I guess he knew that what was going on. At the end of the journey to the Arctic coast, the deer skin was reduced to about the size of a large rabbit skin. We had 2 primus stoves and a good supply of kerosene. These were used for cooking and also constituted all means we had for heating the tent. Fortunately, there was very little wind on the Amituvuk River. This accounted for the deep, soft snow. If there had been a strong wind at times, the traveling would have been a lot easier and better, as the snow would have hardened. My homemade sleeping robe, having seen some rough usage on the trail, often froze to the snow. In the morning I had to tear it loose from the snow. You might say a little better is a little better than nothing. And during the real cold night, my sleep was very limited. The fact that we were on short rations and losing a lot of weight also contributed to the cold being more noticeable. In making camp, we would tramp down the snow with our snowshoes, pitch the tent, then we would lay a canvas on top of the snow as a floor. The oatmeal and cornmeal had by now been fed to the dogs. We had also used as much of the rice as we dared to in the dog food, not knowing how far we were from any resupply. We thought we better save what little rice we had left. While sitting in an easy chair in a nice warm room after sumptuous dinner, the thought of saving such an everyday item as rice for the next meal would never occur. Nor can a person visualize the extreme destitute and hopeless predicament we were in. We all looked like walking fiery ghosts. Our only facility for working was using snow, and actually the only clean or somewhat lighter colored spot on us was around our eyes. The sunglasses that we had to wear at all times during the day also contributed to these light colored spots. The rest of our faces were almost black from the glare of the snow and not a small amount of accumulated dirt. Irv and I, as usual, were cooking dog food one evening. This must be the last cooked food the dogs would receive, unless something happened soon, as this was the last of the little cornmeal that we had left. The oatmeal had been used a long time ago. The other three men of the party were in the tent. Our cooking fire being a distance from the tent, the others could not hear our conversation. As we were cooking a dog, as we had been doing now for several days, having in this way disposed of one whole team or 11 dogs, standing waiting and watching the cooking and cutting some willows at times, I said to Herb, "You know, Herb, I'm so darn hungry, I could eat some of that dog that we're cooking. It smelled real good." Herb said, "So could I. But I have a better idea. You know, I think we have saved our crippled dog long enough. What do you say? Let's cook him, and we can all have a good meal." We had by this time developed a deep fondness for the dog, and he was more or less of a pet. It was with a heavy heart that I consented to Herb's suggestion. After killing and skinning our pet, I went in the tent, got some rice, salt, and a stew pot. When I entered the tent, Sandy asked me what we shot at, thinking that we might have disposed of another dog, as this chore was also left to us. I told the boys in the tent that Herb had just shot a big Arctic hare. Sandy was a little puzzled over this bit of news, as in all our travel on the river, we had never even seen the tracks of a hare. I did not linger long in the tent, as I was afraid that someone might ask me some questions that I could not answer. Returning to the fire, we cut up the best looking meat. All of it was pretty lean. After the meat had cooked for some time, I added some rice. There was no revolting thought in our minds as we waited for the pot to boil, and the smell was most appetizing. When the meat was done, we went in the tent. Everyone ate a big helping, and we finished the stew. To our starving men, it was a real banquet. No one besides Herb and myself knew the truth about the stew, and if they did suspect anything else, they said nothing. At Barrow, a couple of months later, I told Waski the truth, and he promptly got sick of his stomach and said that he would never be able to stand the sight of a dog again, but I guess he finally got over it. Despite our constant use of snow glasses during the day, we all suffered from snow blindness. Dark objects being absent from the Arctic, there was a bright, constant glare, and it seemed that on cloudy days, it was even worse. We found out that using used tea leaves placed between the cloth and laid over the ice when retiring for the night, this was the best remedy. In fact, the only remedy we had. Sandy had learned this years ago over in Siberia. One day, rounding a bend in the river, we came upon a grove of cottonwoods. There were trees 40 to 50 feet high. This grove was on an island in the river, covering an area of about 2 acres. It is still a mystery to me to this day, as I think back, how this forest of cottonwoods happened to find a home in this particular place. We did not see a sign of cottonwood any place else up the river, nor did we see any further down between our where we were and the coast later. Here we could have used our stove as we had left at the summit, but as we had nothing much to cook, it made very little difference. We did not cook for the dogs anymore, as we had nothing to thicken the food with. When a dog died, or we had to kill him, we carried the carcass on the sled. Then when frozen, it was cut up in chunks with the axe, each dog receiving one piece of meat, hide and all. The dogs made short work of their teammates. Being as hungry as they were, I doubt if they knew what they were eating. Camping at the cottonwood grove, Sandy made a decision that I had carried in my mind for a long time, but I had failed to mention it to Sandy, being afraid that I might hurt his feelings. My thought was that if I suggested my plan, he would think that I no longer had faith in his leadership. Herb and I had often talked on my plan. Sandy called us all into the tent as soon as camp was established and revealed what he thought would be a good plan. This is what it finally was decided on. As we were now down to only 2 teams of dogs, Herb and I were to pick out 11 of the best dogs the expedition had left, also the best harnesses and the lightest sled. Herb and I had to draw straws to see which one of us would accompany Sandy. And Herb won the trip. Sandy and Herb were to take their sleeping bags and the bulk of what food we had left. Also, one cut up dog carcass enough to feed their team for 2 days. Their rifles, we now only had one primus stove left, but there was a fair supply of kerosene, the other primus stove having developed a bad leak and had to be discarded. Sandy was reluctant to take our only primus stove, but after I explained to him that we had to camp in a spot now where there was lots of dry cottonwood, all that's available, and I would guarantee a supply or to supply our needs, and we would not be cold, and we also would have the ample cooking facilities for our new food we had left. He finally consented to take the stove. The two men were to build snow igloos at night, having no tent. Sandy had heard that there were Eskimos living on the Colville River, some distance from the coast. His plea was that we were now camped not too far from where the Anaktuvuk River entered into the Colville. In this, he was correct, as we found out not too much later. If before reaching the Eskimo village, a herd of reindeer or caribou should be encountered, they planned on killing a sled load of meat and return at once to our camp. Sandy, knowing the generosity of the Eskimos, had no doubt that supplies could be obtained from them in some form, unless he encountered a village as destitute as we were in. And this, he thought, was not likely, that the Eskimos on the coast were great hunters and usually had a good supply of seal and walrus meat on hand. Some of them also owned reindeer herds, so he thought obtaining food from them would be no problem. Before leaving the next morning, Sandy called me aside, out of hearing from the rest of the party. He said, "If it was not for you, Axel, I would feel real guilty leaving the three of you behind. But knowing you now for several weeks, I feel that I could not leave this camp in charge of a better man. I have therefore informed the other two men that any decision that there is to be made as to the welfare and the survival of the remaining party will be left entirely up to you. I felt proud of the trust that Sandy had placed in me, and I promised to do all I could to carry on until his return. If Sandy and Herb were not back in 7 days, I would, with a light load and the remaining dogs, if any were still alive, or the three of us pulling a sled, would start for the coast. After the boys started the next morning, I started right in, setting camp in shape. It may be human nature, or this may apply only to some people, but it seems that when everything looks hopeless, some people will soon give up and lose all ambition, thinking maybe that what the hell is the use to do anything? We are going to die anyway, and by what should one assert himself? It is a lot easier to lay in the tent or sit by the campfire, as long as there is a man in the party foolish enough to go out and kill a dog and feed it to the rest, also provide all the necessary wood for the campfire and prepare what little food there still remained in our larder. This situation I was now facing in our camp. In writing the above paragraph, I'm not trying in any way to condemn anyone personally. There may have been factors in their life or in the life of the others far beyond my knowledge. Some people are naturally born and brought up in life destined to perform hard work, therefore a more rugged type, and can endure hardship and disappointment to a greater degree in life than others. I know that I fell in this later category I felt, therefore, that it was not a duty placed upon me, but an absolute responsibility to see to the welfare of the other two men. My own life was also in jeopardy. The only ailment I had at this time was suffering something awful from snow blindness. Of course, I was skinny as a rail. My dirty clothes hung on me like a sack. But my determination to lick the Arctic and live was as strong as ever. With the axe in hand, I started out to look for some dry wood, some distance from the camp, and on the opposite side of the cottonwood grove, I heard a noise. Sneaking around, the noise grew louder, sounded like ptarmigan cackling. I still could not see. The tears were streaming down my cheeks from my snow-blind eyes. I grabbed two handfuls of snow, applied them to my eyes for a few minutes. They cleared some, and I then saw a large flock of ptarmigan in the willows. This was the first ptarmigan I had seen on the entire trip. What a surprise it was. I quietly returned to camp, picked up a shotgun and some shells, creeping up on the birch as quietly as possible. When I was what I thought within shooting range, I again applied some snow to my eyes. The ptarmigan appeared to be close enough, as I could see. So I fired the gun into the flock. They were then sitting on the ground, and I killed through three birds with the first shot. Then as they flew up, I emptied my gun, but I don't believe I hit any more. It took me a long time to recover my birds. Their white feathers blended in perfectly with the snow. Even a person with good eyesight can sometimes almost step on a bird without seeing it. The boys were real glad and pleased when I returned to camp with my game. I cleaned the birds at once, saving the neck, guts, and skin for the dog pot. I had decided, as there was plenty of wood available for river camp, to start cooking for the dogs again. The reason was that the weather had not turned quite warm during the day, and the furry dog carcasses did not freeze, making it much harder to cut into equal pieces, and had to be done with a knife. During the colder weather, this job was performed with an axe when the carcasses were frozen. I started a good fire, and Rothman volunteered to watch the stew. I then gathered enough wood to last for the rest of the day and night. Taking the shotgun, I again went hunting, but there was no ptarmigan to be seen, and the glare on the snow too much for me to endure. When back at camp and amongst the willows and the trees, my eyes felt a lot better, as there was something dark or some dark objects to look at. Two dogs had died the night before Sandy's departure. Him and Herb taking one, the one left, I now proceeded to cut up, starting another fire some distance from where Rothman was cooking the stew. I soon had the dog kettle going. Having lots of time and not too many dogs to feed, I had decided to skin the dog carcasses before cooking. It made it a lot easier to cut the carcass up, and I had come to the conclusion that the skin had no food value. I busied myself with other tasks around camp, such as sorting our supplies, checked all the dog harnesses, and discarded the bad ones. I destroyed all the surplus dog harnesses except one for each still living dog and three spares. We had quite a supply of extra harnesses. Sandy, being a Scotchman, would not let us discard a harness from a dog killed or that had died. Having lost more than 20 dogs to date, I could not see an extent in carrying this useless weight any further. I therefore burned all the surplus harnesses and tow line. If I had not destroyed the junk by burning, I was afraid that Sandy, on his return, would tell me to go and find the stuff, and load it on the sled. Burning made this impossible. Tried hunting again the following day, but the ptarmigan had not returned, and we did not see another sign of any ptarmigan on the balance of the trip. The next 3 days were the repetition of the first. Since the boys left, 3 more dogs died, and of 44 dogs that we had leaving the summit, we now had 21 left. This included the team Sandy took to the coast. Of the 10 dogs left in camp, I knew some more would die before long. Some were so weak by now that they could hardly stand up on their feet, and when I fed them, I therefore placed what little food I had for them close enough so that they could keep lying down. I knew this was no good, as the dogs would get hopefully stiff by not moving around at all. I removed the chains from some of the dogs, that is the worst cases, thinking that this would encouraged them to move around a bit, but nothing happened. On the afternoon of the sixth day, Sandy and Herb returned to camp, also with them an Eskimo with a team of 9 dogs. I think Sandy was as glad to see us well and alive as we were to see him and Herb. Now the following is the story of his trip as told to me by Sandy. In the afternoon on the day they left camp, they came to the confluence of the Paulville and the Anisuvuk River. As they had made good time with the light load, Sandy estimated this to be about 24 miles. The traveling on the Colville River was much better in places than on the Anisuvuk River, but there were also a lot of overflow on the river, making it necessary to make frequent detours on the bank of the river, for the snow was soft and deep. Camping the first night in a shelter made from snow blocks with a sled tarpaulin for a roof, an uncomfortable night was spent. Starting out the next morning with only a cup of tea under their belt, I might mention here that our coffee ran out long ago, but we still had some tea. As the pond of tea was a long way, the Eskimos and travelers in the Arctic very seldom used coffee. In fact, some of them never. Early the second day out, the boys saw on the riverbank what looked like a small cabin. Turning their dog team towards this place, it turned out to be a fish cache. On closer inspection, it was found to contain both dried and fresh frozen whitefish. Sandy was jubilant, Herb told me later. He knew now that someone lived not too far away. They camped for a while, eating some fish, also gave the dogs a good feed. It must have been a great surprise to the dogs, getting the fresh fish, the only fish they had had for many weeks. After spending another cold night in a snow igloo, they arrived at the Itkalik village at the mouth of the Itkalik River. Note, I believe this village was abandoned several years later and moved, renamed Uliktuk. The village consisted of 3 sod igloos, 2 smaller and 1 very large igloo, the large one belonging to and being the home of the chief. The boys received a warm, hearty welcome from the Eskimos, and the chief invited them to stay with him. The dogs were unharnessed and fed, sleeping bags were brought in, and the chief's wife prepared a big meal. As Harold told me later, just think, even real good baking powder biscuits. Having had but little sleep for 2 nights and eating a big meal, they soon were snoring. The igloo having no furniture, everybody sat on the floor, also slept on the floor. The floor being covered with reindeer skins laid on top of a layer of willows. All the boys had to do to lean back and were soon sound asleep. When they awoke the following morning, their outer clothes had been removed and someone had covered them with deer skins. While sleeping, the Eskimo women had mended their torn mukluks and clothing. In the morning, when Sandy inquired about grocery supplies in the village, he was told we could have some rice, oatmeal, sugar, and several other items, too numerous to mention. The village had very little meat on hand, but one of the Eskimos volunteered to make a trip to the reindeer camp, 15 miles away, and bring back a couple of reindeer carcasses. This meant that Sandy and Herb could not start on their return journey for another day. However, knowing the uselessness of returning without meat, he decided to stay. One of the Eskimos, with a team of 9 dogs, offered to go along on the return trip. As the guide, he would haul most of the load, having a good team. He also knew of a cutoff on the Caldwell River, seeming a distance equal to at least a day's travel. The meat arrived, and the party started back early in the morning. The owner of the fish cache told Sandy to help himself to all the fish that he wanted, and Sandy did this on the return trip. A great treat for us in camp. In taking the cutoff, only one night had to be spent on the trail. Therefore, reaching what we now call the starvation camp the next day. After we had taken care of the greetings and handshakings, the dogs were unhitched and the sled unloaded. Sandy at once proceeded to cook a big reindeer stew. He also brought out the sugar. The first thing that I did was to fill my mouth with the wonderful sweet stuff. In my estimation, at the moment, there was nothing in the world that could have tasted any better. I then, with Herb's help, cut up a lot of deer meat, also adding some seal oil obtained from the meat at the Eskimo. We also added oatmeal. When we fed our starving dogs this good meal, it seemed that some of them perked up at once. But there were several of the dogs that was beyond any help we could give them. And their usefulness to us was at the end. We placed the food in front of them, but no attempt was made to eat. Even a small morsel. Herb and I then mercifully disposed of 7 more dogs. This left the expedition with 14 dogs in all. The surviving dogs, not being used for fresh meat, all developed diarrhea shortly after eating. Also, all of us men developed the same unpleasant ailment. Fortunately, this occurred only after the first meal. After this, our stomachs shrunken responded favorably to this unusual treatment of good food. Sandy, knowing my sleeping bag could no longer keep me warm at night, had obtained a reindeer sleeping bag for me at Itkalik. What a wonderful feeling it was to crawl into this bag. The reindeer hair was turned inside, and the bag had no lining or blanket covering the fur. as the deer hair is brittle and breaks off easy. It was so that when I emerged from the bag in the morning, I was covered all over with reindeer hair. The boys told me that all that was necessary was a pair of horns, and I could surely pass as a reindeer. But this did not in any way dampen my enthusiasm for the sleeping bag, as I had never before on the entire trip enjoyed such a wonderful warm sleep. After much deliberation amongst us and Sandy, finalization was to cache the polar plant and all heavy radio equipment. This equipment constituted the bulk of our load. And to split the remaining dogs into two teams, and with the help of the Eskimo and his team, leave for the coast in the morning, taking only the lighter radio and all the camera equipment. Our loads would still be plenty heavy. That is for the shape of our dogs. We cached everything not absolutely necessary for the trip, loaded our sled, and everything was in readiness for an early start. Sandy intended to send two Eskimo dog teams from the coast later to recover the polar plant and radio equipment. Why this was not done, I don't know. I will take this opportunity to explain what I learned later about the matter. On arriving at the village of Iqaluit, Sandy decided to hire one dog team in addition to the one we were now using that belonged to the Eskimo that was already helping the expedition. These two teams being the only ones available at the village, he was told that there was no dog teams available at Tamichi Point on the coast. The urgent need of Rossman to be at Barrow, and also for Wasky to be there, Sandy was sure that batteries for the small radio set could be obtained at Barrow, making it possible for Wasky to send weather reports to Captain Wilkins in the event that something had happened to delay his plans and therefore had not as yet departed from Fairbanks. As the only teams available, therefore were hired to take Sandy, Rossman, and Wasky to Barrow. The salvaging of the equipment stored on the Anaktuvuk River would have to wait until the two teams return from their Barrow trip. With the expedition dogs, Herb and I were to stay at the trading post at Beach Point until the team had recuperated sufficiently for us to continue our trip to Barrow, a distance from Beach Point of approximately 200 miles. After the Eskimo and their dog teams returned from Barrow, they were to go up the river, recover the equipment, and bring it to Beachy Point. Herb and I would then bring it on to Barrow. The Eskimos did not contact us on their return, nor did we see any sign of them later. Having waited at Beachy Point for 10 days and not having a word from the Eskimos, we decided to start for Barrow. It was now in the month of May, and not being acquainted with the lateness of the Arctic spring, to us the month of May seemed to be as late as anyone would want to travel 200 miles over the ice to Barrow. Had we known that there was still ample time left, we would have returned up the river a distance of 120 miles, recovered some of the most valuable and necessary parts of the equipment, as our dogs by now had, after a long rest and good food, recovered as we thought sufficiently to make this trip. Had we decided on our own to make this trip, we would have acted strictly against Sandy's orders. It was therefore abandoned. I heard years later that some trader had discouraged the Eskimos from making the trip in order to gain possession of the equipment for his own benefit. I have no other knowledge of this except rumors, so cannot accuse anyone of this particular deed. The foregoing, I believe, will enlighten the reader. At least, that's all I know about the equipment. It may be that nothing was ever recovered, and that the stuff may be rusting away on the Anacortes River to this day, 40 years later. Now back to the original story. Starting out the next morning with the Eskimo team taking the lead, it was impossible for us to keep up with him with our starved dogs, even though our loads were light, hardly anything on our sled. He often waited for us to catch up. When we arrived at the fish cache, he was waiting for us. We fed the dogs some fish. Herb and I each took a frozen whitefish. I still today enjoy frozen crawfish. When I started chewing on that frozen fish, I noticed my teeth and gums were sore. Later, when I told this to an old timer, he told me that it was the first sign of scurvy. This soreness disappeared in a few days after eating fresh meat. I would keep the frozen whitefish in my parka pocket and chew on it as I traveled along. It really helped to keep the hunger away, at least for the time being. We arrived at the village without incident, having a good guide. The chief insisted that we all stay in his large igloo. To us, having slept in a cold tent for a long time, this was a wonderful thing, and we accepted the invitation gladly. After entering the igloo, I wish we had set up the tent. Having spent a long time in the open and in the fresh air, the smell and the heat in the igloo almost knocked me over. The chief's wife, having expected us this day, had a big stew cooking on the stove. We did not know what was cooking, but it sure had some appetizing aroma. When the stew was done, she invited us to help ourselves. Having brought in our own eating utensils from the sled, and as hungry as we needed no additional probing. We filled our bowls with the stew, and it was sure delicious. Returning for a second helping, Herb right behind me. As I dipped deeper in the pot, something looked like macaroni in the bottom. I said to Herb, "There is macaroni in the stew, but you have to dip deep in order to get some." He filled his bowl, and we sat down and started to eat. Herb gave me a dirty look for some reason, and I found out later that what we thought to be macaroni was ptarmigan entrails, as it was not polite to leave anything kind of food in your dish. We ate everything, and I guess it did not hurt us. This was also the first time I had ever seen muktuk. Muktuk is the skin of a whale, of a bowhead whale, the other skin being of black color, about an inch or so thick, and the second layer of skin about the same thickness, but white in color. In texture and tenderness, I would compare it with a rubber truck tire. But to the Eskimos, with their strong feet, it is a great delicacy. And at their potlatches, the most sought after dish. The chief wife had a large tray filled with cut up chunks of this rare food item.